All right, well, let's go ahead and get started with Revelation chapter 9. And this continues on the trumpet judgments. And remember that we're dealing with three sets of judgments. We started off dealing with the seal judgments, which were mentioned in Revelation chapter 6, followed by the interlude with the discussion of the 144,000 Jewish believers or servants, and then the scene in heaven that follows that. And then when we get into Revelation 7 and 8, we're dealing with the trumpet judgments. And then when we get over into Revelation chapter 16, we're going to be dealing with the bowl judgments. So we're still dealing with the trumpet judgments here. And as we mentioned in the last hour, the four trumpet judgments deal with things seen, things within nature. And now that we move into the next three trumpet judgments, we're going to be dealing with things unseen. We're going to be dealing with demonic forces, as it were. And so picking up in Revelation chapter 9, verse 1, it says, "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him." Now remember I said in the last hour that when we're talking about stars, stars refer to light-emitting objects. And there are a number of instances where a star will refer to an astronomical body, a sun, a planet, that sort of thing. But stars are also used to refer to angels. And that's what we have here with this reference to a star. Because he says here, and he says, "I saw a star from heaven," but then when you get down to the last part of verse 1, that it says, "And the key of the bottomless pit was given to not it, but given to him." And so we know that this reference to a star is to an angelic being. So he says, "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to earth." And there's a lot of consideration here that this is a reference to Satan as an angelic being, which we know that he is. But it says here, "And the key of the bottomless pit," and here "bottomless pit" translates the Greek word abusos, which, and sometimes it's transliterated as abyss. I think the King James Version calls it the abyss. I think anyway. But here he's given this key to the bottomless pit, and it says, "was given to him." Now this bottomless pit, this abusos, we know from Luke chapter 8 verse 31 that this is a reference to a demonic prison. We might think of it as the Alcatraz for demons. And so here in Luke, and I'm going to back up just a little bit here in Luke, and this is talking about Jesus and his ministry, his authority over demons. And in Luke 8:26 it says, "Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee." I'm in Luke 8:26. "And when he came out onto the land, he was met by a man from the city who was possessed with demons." And again here we have plural. We have multiple demons inside this one person. "And who had not put on any clothing for a long time and was not living in a house but in the tombs. And seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said in a loud voice, 'What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?'" It's interesting that these demons were able to see past the humanity of Jesus and to see him for who he is with regard to his divine nature. So again, there's some capacity that they have to see in the spiritual realm beyond what we have. So they identify him as the Son of the Most High God, and they say, "I beg you, do not torment me." And this also speaks of the authority of Jesus over demonic beings. Verse 29, "For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would break his bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert." And Jesus asked him, said, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion, for we are many many demons have entered him." But notice verse 31, "And they were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss." Now that's our same word here, the Greek word abusos.
Mine's got deep.
Okay. Well, what we have to understand from the context of Revelation 9 and from Luke 8 here is that this is a reference to a prison where apparently some very, very, very bad demons are currently being kept. Now, there's a lot of demons that are roaming around on the earth at this time, and they're causing a lot of havoc. But there are demons that are going to be released that are really going to really open up the gates of hell, as it were, upon the human race. So again, when this star, and we'll take it as Satan, had fallen from heaven. And by the way, when it says which had fallen, in the Greek that's in the perfect tense, which describes a past action. So this was a time when this star, this angelic being, had fallen sometime in the past. And, you know, again, one can't be dogmatic, but all the signs seem to point to this being Satan. It says in the key, and again, what does this spiritual key look like? I mean, it's hard to imagine things in the spiritual realm. But apparently this prison has a locked door. And there's a key to this bottomless pit, and it says, "was given to him." And this is something that, again, that from the throne of heaven, there is now being given permission to open this pit, as we're about to see. But it was given to him. He doesn't have it on his own. And again, this demonstrates the control of heaven over things related to the earth and things related to the spiritual realm. Verse 2, "And he opened the bottomless pit," or he opens this abyss, "and smoke went up out of it." And again, I've underscored the word "like" throughout here many times, because "like" and "as" occur in Revelation chapter 9 more than any other chapter in the book of Revelation. And John is struggling here. He's seeing things that he's never seen before. He's seeing things in the spirit realm, and he's seeing things in the future. And he's really struggling because he has a vocabulary. He has a bank of words that he is drawing from. And he's trying to compare these things, spiritual and heavenly, and these things in the future, and he's using his language. And one can imagine the struggle that John is having here, and how much we too might struggle in this kind of situation if we were trying to describe something that we had never seen before, and yet, you know, using our own bank of vocabulary, how would we describe it? And so that's what John's doing here. He's really, you can almost feel like he's struggling to really capture it. But he says, "And smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit." And then John gives us a description of what comes forth here. He says, "And out of the smoke came forth locusts upon the earth." And again, there's questions, you know, are these literal locusts? I don't think so. I think that these are demonic beings. And so considering their prison, I take it that these are most likely demons, simply being described as locusts. And it says, "And power was given to them as scorpions of the earth have power." That is, that they have the power to inflict pain. I've never been bitten by a scorpion. When I was a little boy growing up in Southern California in the Mojave Desert, we used to catch scorpions all the time, these great big green ones. I mean, they were fabulous creatures. And you'd go out there and start flipping boards and rocks. And when I was a little kid in the 4th and 5th and 6th grade going to Linda Verde Elementary School in Lancaster, we'd get to the bus stop early, you know, 30, 40 minutes early. We'd be out there in the field, you know, trying to catch blue racers, red racers, garter snakes, scorpions, tarantulas. I mean, it was just a little forest of little, you know, bugs and lizards and critters and whatnot, and sometimes we'd catch them, and then we'd take them to school and put them in the girls' desk, you know, and they'd flip open the desk, you know, and then you'd get in trouble. One of the reasons why I got spanked by the principal one time, back when principal spanked in the day. But I've never been bitten by a scorpion, but those little stingers they have are pretty incredible. Now, my dad was bitten one time. We were living in Victorville, California, which is on the edge of the Mojave Desert. And he used to put his cowboy boots outside the door in the evening. And I don't know why he did it, just let him air out, I guess. But sure enough, one day I wasn't there. I was in the back bedroom. But all of a sudden, I heard my dad screaming from the living room. And I came running in there to see what was going on, and a scorpion had crawled inside his boot, and when he put his foot in there, bam, it tagged him on his foot. And the pain that he experienced was pretty incredible. And I remember his portion of his foot swelled up, and I mean, he was in pain for quite some time. I don't remember if it was days or weeks, but I remember he was in pain for quite a while. And so one can imagine, especially at this point, you know, when John is writing, you know, that current audiences would have understood what he was talking about. So again, this ability to inflict pain. In verse 4 it says, "And they were told that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads." And so I take this to be a reference to unbelievers is who they are going to be attacking, those who are in rebellion against God. And remember that there are a lot of people who are saved out of the tribulation. I was having a discussion with somebody recently because we were talking about the judgments that come upon people during the time of the tribulation, and we were talking about how their attitude that even though they know the judgments are from God and they know the judgments are because of their rebellion against God, they still refuse to repent. And they will not turn from their idolatries and their sinful behavior. And so the question was brought up, you know, because we were talking about the behavior of people throughout the book of Revelation and how depraved humanity is in the face of God's judgments upon the earth. And anyway, this guy asked me, he said, "Well, you know, is there any grace in the book of Revelation?" I said, "Well, sure." I said, "You see it throughout." I said, "And you see it most pronounced in the lives of those people who are saved during the time of the tribulation." And I even went back to Revelation 7, verse 9, where John describes, he says, "After these things, I looked and behold a great multitude which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands, and they cry out with a loud voice, saying, 'Salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" And that you have this this vast multitudes, probably in the millions of people. And so John saw these things, and then of course, you know, one of the elders approaches him in verse 13. And said to me, "These who are clothed in white robes, who are they and where have they come from?" And I said, "My Lord, you know." And he said, "These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation, and they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." So you do have many people who are saved during the time of the tribulation, and you see the grace of God. But you also have the larger picture is of those who are being judged. And we don't want to lose sight of the grace and that is going to be shown to people who turn to God. But again, we want the picture as it's going to be most pronounced upon those who are being judged. And so again, they were told, verse 4, that they were told. So there was a command given to them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth. And by the way, locusts, that's what they attack. When do locusts ever attack people? And again, that's one of the reasons why I think that this is a reference to demonic beings. These are not to be taken as literal locusts here.
Could it be, as you know, the locusts come in thousands of them?
Yeah, well,
it would be sort of like the number just coming out of there?
Yeah. But we're about to see the way that they're described here.
You know, that would depend on whether you took that as a narrative or as a narrative, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were told that they should not or would not attack these locusts are coming out, and I'm going to tell you, they're not going to attack the grass.
Right.
Or they've been told not to attack the grass. So that would be interesting to see how they lay that out in the Greek.
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't have a chance to check that out. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying.
Because the way I was reading it, it was like they were told that they should not, they were ordered that they should not attack the grass.
Right.
So I was thinking, well, these demons aren't going to be attacking the grass anyway. So then I was thinking...
Right, so why even say that?
Why even say that? I was thinking that it was locusts, and the locusts were told not to attack the grass, but
seeing that the locusts eat everything in sight.
Mm-hmm. But in this case, and we're about to see the way that John's going to describe them.
Okay.
Because you've never seen locusts described like this before. Pretty sure. But they were told to hurt only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Again, a reference to unbelievers here. Verse 5, and they were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. So if they were not permitted to kill anyone, again, it speaks of their ability, what they can do. And again, they were to torment for 5 months. And again, a very controlled form of suffering, a very controlled. So you're not only talking about who can be attacked, but you're talking about also the severity of the attack, that it cannot come to the point of death. And you're also talking about the duration of the attack, that everything here is limited as far as who, as far as the kind of suffering, and as far as the duration of the suffering. And then John says, and their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. And in verse 6 he says, and in those days men will seek death and will not find it. And they will long to die, and death flees from them. Isn't that interesting? So this is a supernatural form of keeping people alive. That they will not be, they will seek death, they will pursue death, but God will not permit them to die. In other words, he's going to keep them alive to face this punishment. Isn't that interesting? Say what?
Kind of like a torture.
It is a torture. Yeah, it is a suffering. It is a judgment that God is pouring out upon these people. Right.
And here no one's dying.
Right, right. They're not going to be dying. Now, there is going to be some death that's going to occur here in a little bit that we're about to read. But at this point, God's in control of everything. Again, he's in control of the agents of suffering. He's in control of the degree with which they are permitted to cause suffering. Who can be afflicted? Only those who do not have the seal of God. So it's very targeted. The duration of it is very controlled, and again, people are not going to be able to escape it. You know, they're going to seek death, but death flees from them. Again, it's very interesting. Again, it shows the control of heaven over these judgments, and how the judgments are tailored, how they're very specific to the individuals. And then John gives us some appearance here. He says, and the appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads, as it were, crowns like gold. And their faces were like the faces of men, and they had hair like the hair of women. You would think long hair. And their teeth were like the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots of many horses rushing to battle. And they have tails like scorpions and stings, and in their tails is the power to hurt men for 5 months. Now some have thought that John here was seeing helicopters. Because of the picture, that this would be a picture of modern warfare. I don't rule that out, but you have to come up with one of two conclusions. In my brain, you do. You have to say that either the demonic forces are behind the human forces that would here be pictured as military, that they are behind the human forces and controlling the human forces to inflict the pain. Or you would have to say that this is just a description of these demons as John sees them as demons. I tend to go with this being the description of them as demons. But I don't rule out the other possibility, that it could be something that John is describing. But you cannot dismiss the fact that there is a fallen angel, a star, and the fact that there the abyss was opened and these demons were released, and that they are the ones who are controlling the suffering that is being caused. And whether they are doing it immediately or directly, or whether they are doing it immediately through the agency of humans, one cannot be certain. I tend to take it that it's direct. I tend to take it that these are demonic beings that are unleashed, that are able to attack people. And John here gives us a description of them. And again, the emphasis that they have the power to hurt men for 5 months. Now, to argue that it could be something with reference to human forces, we do have examples, and I've mentioned it 100 times, so we'll make it 101. But over in Revelation 16, we have that example of the sixth angel, verse 12, where we have these demons that go forth to call the kings of the earth into battle. And in Revelation 16, verse 12, it says, "The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river, the Euphrates, and its water was dried up." And we're about to see the Euphrates here in just a minute. But again, he pours out his bowl on the great river, the Euphrates, and its water was dried up, so that they would be prepared, so that the way would be prepared for the kings from the east. And then he says, "And I saw coming..." Now, those kings of the east, those are taken to be political rulers. Okay. Verse 13, "And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet..." There we have the unholy trinity, as it's called. "Three unclean spirits like frogs." So whereas the demons that we're looking at here are compared to locusts, these demons are compared to frogs. And then he says in verse 14, "For they," these unclean spirits, "for they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty." So clearly in this passage we have these demons who are controlling political world rulers who will marshal their armies in anticipation of the Lord's coming and this battle that's going to take place at Armageddon.
I still think they killed me.
Huh?
And they still think they killed me.
Oh yeah, it's a form of insanity. Once people shut God out, you know, what goes on in the brain is, well, it's divorced from reality. So again, it could be either way. I tend to take it that these demons are attacking directly, that it is they who are doing the harm.
Even once you make it the teeth of lions, I can get everything else, but I have a hard time picturing the teeth of lions. And you've got the teeth in italics, so...
Right. It's not in the Greek, right? It's an interpreter's word that they've inserted there. Ferocious. when a lion shows its teeth, it's in attack mode. It's in a threatening mode, war mode, we could say, if we want to fit it to the context here. And again, the description here where he uses the term like and like and like and like and like and like, and you know, again, John's wrestling. He's borrowing from his bank of words you know, to try to describe these beings. And then he goes on in verse 11, he says, and they have as king over them. Now that's interesting to me because it speaks of an authority structure, a hierarchical structure. We could call him a commander, as it were. And they have as king over them the angel of the abyss, and his name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in the Greek he has the name Apollyon. Now both Abaddon and Apollyon, from the Hebrew and the Greek respectively, both words mean destroyer. It's the same thing. And so this they have this king over them who is in effect directing them to their task of causing harm. And then John tells us the first woe is past. So this first woe here being past completes the fifth trumpet judgment that we read in verse 1. And then he tells us, he said, behold, two woes are still coming after these things. And so, you know, again, these woes, when we think of the first four trumpet judgments that are upon the earth, we think, man, that's pretty heavy stuff. But again, this is amplified. This is really ramping up here. And again, it's coming out of the unseen spiritual realm. And by the way, this should challenge us too with regard to how we think about things, because we tend to think about the things that are most dangerous to us as things within the realm of the seen, you know, the things that are most obvious and visible to us. Whereas biblically, it's behind the scenes. It's the things that are unseen that are often the most dangerous, because it's the unseen things that go on in the demonic realm and in the angelic realm. Angels are involved in doing God's will. We know that there's warfare that goes on in the angelic realm. I mean, read Daniel 10 sometime, where you have this Michael and Gabriel fighting against these princes of Persia and Greece. And when you read that in the context, you realize that these are demonic princes who rule over geographical regions. And there's these battles that take place in the heavenly realm. There's even a section in the book of Kings where Elisha, remember when this army comes to take him by force, and his servant looks out the window and sees these armies and says, oh, what are we going to do? And Elisha says, well, don't worry, because those who are for us are greater than those who are against us. And he prays that the Lord opens his servant's eyes. And what does he see? He sees the mountains that are full of chariots of fire. Well, what is that? That's the angels of the Lord. Right, those military battle of soldiers or warriors in the angelic realm who are there to fight battles that we don't see and we'll never see, but it's warfare that nonetheless takes place. And when you think of angels, you think of angels really in two categories. You think of those who are angels who are unfallen, who are God's angels. And then you think of those angels that are fallen that Matthew 25 verse 31 refers to as Satan's angels, where it talks about the lake of fire, which was prepared for the devil and his angels. And so when we read about these demons that come out of the abyss, these demons are those groups of angels that belong to Satan. And when we think about satanic angels, we have to break that down into two categories. We have to break that down into the category of demons that are currently free and roaming about, like those described over in Luke 8, where Jesus found the man possessed, right, with demons, multitude, a legion. Legion was about 6,000. So that's a lot of demons inside one person, right? And so you have those demons who are free. And then you have those demons that are currently imprisoned or incarcerated, like these here in the abyss, and we're about to read about some more, that are trapped under the river Euphrates. And again, you know, what do these spiritual prisons look like? We don't know, you know, but again, we're given some description here. And again, from the context, we know that there's some authority structure because, you know, those that come out of the abyss, they have a king over them. A fallen angel whose name is Abaddon or Apollyon, destroyer, and even his name would signify something about his character, you know, what he sets out to do. You know, he's a destroyer. And so, you know, we're able to construct something of a theological framework when we begin to think about classes of demons and how they function, how they're organized in the angelic realm. And we can't dismiss that. Even in our daily activities with people, I've seen human behavior with people and strongly suspected that there was demonic activity there behind what was going on. And of course, we've studied demons before. By the way, I'm not next Tuesday, but the Tuesday after, I'm starting back with my second round of classes at the seminary at Tyndale. I think the 16th, the week of the 16th.
I thought it was the
6th. No, it's the 16th, I think.
My school starts the 13th.
The 13th. Well, my first class will be on Tuesday the 14th. Anyway, I'll be teaching the second part to Survey of Theology from 6 to 8 on Tuesday evenings if anybody wants to attend. It's free.
Sure.
Yeah. but we're going to be getting into issues of angelology and demonology at that time. So we'll unpack more of that when we get into that. So anyway. All right, well let me get on to this and we'll discuss this a little bit more here as we move through this. So verse 12, the first woe is past. Behold, two woes are still coming after these things. Verse 13, and the sixth angel sounded. Now the seventh angel does not sound until Revelation 11, 15. So all we're going to see at the end of this section here is just concluding out the sixth trumpet. And so after we get through with this section, we're going to have an interlude that occurs from Revelation 10:1 to 11:14. So that'll be our next week's lesson, as we'll hit Revelation 10 and 11. And we'll see this interlude before we see the sounding of the seventh trumpet. So he says again in verse 13, and the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the altar, which is before God. And one saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. And I put in here in brackets that these four angels are fallen angels, that these are going to be demons. Verse 15, and the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released so that they might kill a third of mankind. Now, when he says here that they had been prepared for the hour, the definite article appears in the Greek here. So this is a very definite time. This is the hour and day and month and year. This speaks of a very specific time. So these angels who are here, they are about to be released, these four angels. And again, this is all part of God's timetable. And we want, again, to see the sovereignty of God at play here. And we want to see the control of God. Too often, I think Christianity, many Christians come and they think about God and Satan almost as opposites, as equal opposites. And that there's this battle that's taken place and who's going to win. And the Bible never presents Satan as God's opposite
or equal
by any means. He's a creature. He's limited in time, in space, in power. He's just a creature. And we should never, see them as being side by side.
He's a usurper, and usually a usurper is underneath the authority of another person.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. He's a usurper, and he is under the authority of God. And God certainly permits him to act. He permitted him to fall. He permitted him to lead angels with him in his rebellion in heaven. And the first sin was a sin that took place in heaven, came to earth, Adam and Eve, human race, here we are.
Well, even in the book of Job, right, where he's coming to and from heaven,
yeah,
he's, telling God, right, that, yeah, he only loves you because you're protecting him.
Yeah.
And so he had to have God's authority.
That's right.
To actually do anything. So it would...
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're 100% right, because you take it that God brings up Job to Satan. He says, have you considered my servant Job? And Satan says, well, yeah, I have. Yeah, he praises you, but you've got a hedge about him. And so you bought him. You paid him off, God. You put a hedge about him, sure. You know, that's why he praises you. But he says, in effect, remove that hedge. And touch all that he has, and the challenge is what? He'll curse you to your face. And so God says, okay. So he takes off the restraint, and he allows Satan to come and to attack Job. He doesn't attack him initially. He attacks his business. He attacks his family. Eventually, he attacks his health. But
he couldn't kill him.
He could, right. Even then, he restrains him. Mm-hmm. But God does permit him to attack Job, and he limits it. But you're right. I mean, he has to have permission, and God grants it. It's just like with the angel that has fallen. And a key of the bottomless pit was given to him. He didn't have it. He just doesn't just walk around with this key ready to open it when he wants. It's given to him at a specific time. And all of these activities, all this release of demons, all of this things that's going on in the spiritual realm is, again, all part of God's sovereign control. And it shows God as being sovereign and in absolute complete control over all these things. And not only with regard to, again, who is attacked, the form of attack, the duration of the attack, but you know, even down here to the very day, you know, to the very hour, you know, for the hour and the day and the month and the year, you know, these four angels, it says, who had been prepared. So they're currently being held, they're currently being restrained, you know, at the great river Euphrates, and they were released, he says. And then he says, so that they might kill a third of mankind. So whereas before, the suffering was for the duration of 5 months, and people will seek after death and will not be able to find it because death will flee from them, here God ramps it up and he allows these four angels to be released so that they might kill a third of mankind. Now what's interesting is back in Revelation 6, verses 7 and 8, it was declared that a fourth of humanity would be killed at that time. And here, one third of remaining humanity would be destroyed. And what this comes out to is half of humanity is killed up to this point.
That's just half of what's left after the tribulation.
Right. Yeah.
What
yep. He said it was the half that was left after the tribulation. After the rapture, right? So let me simplify it down into numbers here. So if we have 100 people, and in Revelation 6, 7, and 8, you have 25% are killed. What does that leave? Leave 75. Now in this section, you have these four angels who are going to kill a third of the remaining humanity. How many is that? That's 25. And so now you're left with half, you see. So that's how you come up with the half, if you do it on a very simple way of understanding it that way. But if you think about in the billions, I mean, if it were to occur now, what's the population of the planet now? It's over 7 billion. Aren't we roughly about 7 billion, somewhere in there?
That's just China.
Huh?
That's just China.
Well, yeah, China's over a billion themselves. But anyway, these four angels are released, and they're given authority so that they might kill a third of mankind. And he says in verse 16, and the number of the armies of the horsemen was 200 million. And John says, I heard the number of them. Well, he heard the number because to see that many and to count them would take a while, wouldn't it? And John doesn't say, I saw them and counted them. He says, I heard the number. Now again, the question is raised that they have the number of the armies of the horsemen are 200 million. Well, who are these 200 million horsemen? Who is this 200 person army? And it kind of goes back and forth. Are these humans? Are these people? Or are these demonic beings that are doing this activity? You read commentaries on Revelation from 150, 200 years ago, and everybody would say, well, this couldn't be a human army. There's absolutely no way, because there's no human army that's that big. There's no army of 200 million people. But there was a comment made, and many theologians have latched onto it and included it in their commentaries and theological works. Back in May of 1965, in Time magazine, as a matter of fact, I think it was on page 35, that Red China boasted an army of 200 million. And that would be interesting because China is which direction from Israel? It's east. And if you think about the comment that was made back in Revelation 16 about how the judgment was poured out upon the Euphrates River so that the river was dried up so that the kings from the east could come. And when you think about prophecy and these things that are being communicated, it's all with reference to Israel. And so that's sort of the center point that we have to think about things from north, south, east, and west. And so again, it raises the possibility that this could be a reference to an army of people. Again, we go back to the issue that it could be a reference to demons. In that case, the attacks would be immediate, direct. If it is a reference to humans, then it could be a reference to an army that could come from China, from that direction. But either way, either it's directly demons who are doing the attacking, or it's people who are supernaturally directed by demons to attack. And the primary emphasis here, whichever way you take it, is that there's demonic activity here that's driving this. And that's the thing you don't want to lose focus on. I mean, you can kind of go back and forth on how do you interpret the 200 million. What you can't get away from is the demonic activity that's driving this army. And verse 17, "And this is how I saw in the vision the horses and those who sat on them. The riders had breastplates, the color of fire, which would be red, and of hyacinth, which would be blue, and of brimstone, which would be yellow." In fact, I think the Holman Christian Standard Bible, I think, even puts those colors in there in their translation. Do they have it in there, Dan?
Yeah.
Okay, how does that read?
Breastplates that were fiery red, hyacinth blue, and sulfur yellow.
Okay. So John gives us these color schemes here. And he says, "And the heads of the horses are like the heads of lions, and out of their mouth... and out of their mouths proceed fire and smoke and brimstone." Now, what that clearly symbolizes is judgment. But again, some have pictured here tanks as instruments of war. Because one can imagine fire and smoke, coming out of the mouth of a tank. Again, it's possible. I'm not going to be dogmatic here. Right. Yeah. And some have even thought that this might be a reference to volcanic activity, destruction upon the earth. Again, what you cannot get away from is the demonic activity that's driving this judgment. So verse 18, "And a third of mankind was killed by these three plagues, by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone." Again, it could be perhaps a reference to volcanic activity triggered by demons, which proceeded out of their mouths. "For the power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents and have heads, and with them they do harm." And then he says, and John gives us these glimpses into human nature during this time. He gives us these glimpses into human nature. He says, "And the rest of mankind..." And here this is reference to unbelievers, "who were not killed by these plagues, did not repent of the works of their hands," which ultimately is the cause of their receiving judgment, "so as not to worship demons and idols of gold and of silver and of brass and of stone and of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their immorality, nor of their thefts." You would think that judgment of this magnitude, of this severity, would drive people to repent and turn to the Lord in order to avoid all this. But no matter how severe the judgment, the human heart is such that people will not turn from their sinfulness. And we scratch our heads at it. But again, it's a picture of human depravity, of human nature. Let me give you a few other examples, because the book of Revelation hits on this a few times. Go back with me to Revelation 6:14. I'm just going to hit on a few verses, and we're not going to spend much time here. I'm just going to hit on a few quick verses. And we've hit on these before, but I want to go back and hit these again so that we can see this response of human nature, that as God begins to pour out his judgments upon the earth, the human response among unbelievers is pretty consistent. Now, you do have, again, those who do turn to God. You think of the multitudes who are worshiping God, who come out of the tribulation. There are those. But of those who are stiff-necked, who are unrepentant, they will not bow the knee. And Revelation 6:14 says, "The sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. Then the kings of the earth and the great men, the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks and of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, 'Fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb.'" Really? You're going to pray to the rocks to hide you from God? I mean, that's again a form of spiritual insanity. And then in Revelation 9:6, which we've already looked at, it says, "In those days men will seek death rather than seek God. They will seek death and will not find it, and they will long to die, and death will flee from them." And then this section we just read, that the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands so as not to worship demons and the idols of gold and of silver and of brass and of stone and of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their immorality, nor of their thefts. And by the way, the word sorceries translates the Greek word pharmakia, the word we get for pharmacy. And it's thought that these are people who engage in occultic practices and perhaps use drugs to help stimulate their occultic practices. Chapter 11, verse 7, "When they have finished," when the two witnesses of God have finished their testimony, "the beast who comes out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them." Again, this is by divine permission. "And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which mystically is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. And those from the peoples and tribes and tongues and nations will look at their dead bodies for 3.5 days and will not permit their bodies to be laid in a tomb. And those who dwell on the earth," again, unbelievers here, "will rejoice over them and celebrate that God's people were here put to death. And they will send gifts to one another because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth." Again, speaking about the depravity of human nature. And then over in Revelation 13, 3. Again, this speaks of those who are on the earth. He says, "And I saw the head, one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole world was amazed and did what? Followed after the beast. And they worshipped" who?
The dragon.
"Because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him?'" Again, it speaks of the mind and the values of these people. And then over in Revelation 16:8, it says, "The fourth angel poured out his bowl upon the sun, and it was given to it to scorch men with fire." And verse 9, "And men were scorched with fire and heat, and they blasphemed the name of God who has the power over these plagues, and they did not repent so as to give him glory." And then verse 11, "And they blasphemed the name of the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and they did not repent of their deeds." And you just look at this and you see this over and over and over in this repeated pattern of how these people are responding, and you begin to get a glimpse into the human heart. And it shows that whether God extends them grace or whether he's pouring out judgment, they know the source and they know why he's judging them. And their response is to pray to the rocks, worship the dragon, blaspheme the name of God, celebrate the death of God's people. The word that keeps popping to mind is the word depravity. They're just totally depraved to the core of their being. And this is the vast majority of humanity who has turned away from God. It's a very dark picture of the. The Bible doesn't flatter man. The Bible does not flatter people by any means. Well, let me take up these summary points and then we'll call it quits. In Revelation chapter 9, John reveals the sounding of the fifth and sixth trumpets, the first and second woes, which bring God's continued judgment upon the world. Now, John opens with a scene in which he says, I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. And we know this star is an angel sent to release demonic creatures from their current state of captivity. And once released, are sent on a specific mission to torment only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they are not permitted to kill anyone but to torment for 5 months. So their authority is limited concerning their target, concerning the extent of injury inflicted, and the duration of their activity. And the pain imposed by these creatures will prompt men to seek death, but it will flee from them. John then provides a detailed description of these creatures as having features like a locust with the face of a man, long hair like women, teeth like a lion, breastplates of iron, wings and tails like a scorpion. And the leader of this army is called Abaddon and Apollyon, which from both the Hebrew and the Greek both means destroyer. Then the fifth trumpet concludes the first woe. Then the sixth angel sounded his trumpet in heaven, and he was commanded to release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. And we saw about them. We'll see them again in Revelation 16, or at least the reference to the Euphrates River. Now, these four angels are given authority to kill a third of mankind, and to accomplish this task, they command an army of 200 million soldiers. And again, whether demons or men, it's not certain. But these demons will send plagues upon mankind. And again, I mentioned earlier that Elisha the prophet once saw an angelic army. So the two woes described in Revelation 9 correspond with the words of Daniel and Jesus concerning the destruction that will come upon the great tribulation. And that if God did not intervene, that all mankind would be destroyed. And those people who remain alive after this destruction refuse to repent of their idolatry and sinful ways. I have a quote here from Ryrie. He says, at least three realities stand out from this chapter. One, the reality and power of the unseen world of demons and Satan. Two, the reality of God who judges. And three, the reality of the hardness of sinful human hearts. I think that's pretty straightforward.